He's written songs for Grover Washington Jr. and Anita Baker, is a tenor saxophonist and the recipient of numerous musical awards. Yet, he's probably best known for his penetrating memoir, The Color of Water, a black man's tribute to his white mother. Hello, I'm Valerie Jackson, and today I'm going between the lines of Song Yet Sung by best-selling author James McBride. Welcome back, James. It's good to see you again.
Well, good to be seen. Thank you.
Well, I thoroughly enjoyed your first novel, which was Miracle at St. Anna. As a matter of fact, Spike Lee, I think, is working with you to produce that into a movie, right?
Yeah, he finished it. It's already finished. It's coming out October 10th of 2008.
That's a fabulous story of four African-American soldiers in Italy during World War II. And if you haven't read the book, I strongly recommend it. But today we're here to talk about Song Yet Sung. Now, you go even further back in history than World War II in this book, back to slavery. Much has been written about slavery in this country, but Song Yet Sung comes from a slightly different angle, focusing on what I call the nuances of the culture, especially runaway slaves. But for the benefit of our listeners, share with us the premise of the story, Song Yet Sung.
Song Yet Sung is basically about a runaway slave named Liz Spocott who dreams of the future. And the future she dreams of is the today. She dreams of now. And basically the book explores the web of relationships that existed between whites and blacks during that time. And it describes how it's basically a long chase story, more or less. It's like an adventure story with these various themes woven throughout that have to do with her seeing the future and being very – and not being enthused about what she sees.
Right. Well, you refer to slavery, as a matter of fact, as an adventure, a great adventure story. Why do you call it that?
Well, I mean, when you get past the brutality of slavery, it is really quite an adventure story. I mean, for black readers, as a black person, you know, I grew up watching Wild Westerns. You know, and the Wild West there only lasted 20 years, from 1875 to 1895.
True.
But yet there's a whole industry based on, you know, Jesse James and these other guys. So why can't, you know, we create an adventure story based around some of the action that existed during slavery? I mean, even, you know, this whole business of The Matrix, for example. When you see The Matrix, that really was about slavery. You know, who was the one that's going to free us from the clutches of the, you know, the people who create this, you know, macabre world of fiction that we are part of? Slavery was as just as adventurous, except that we didn't have spaceships and,
right,
you know, we didn't have rocket ships and guns and so forth. But we did have music, and we had same kind of intelligence that we have now. So those were our weapons.
And not to mention that slavery, that there was a whole industry around slavery, the whole trade of slave selling and buying and so forth. And
well, the economy of slavery was something that powered American society. And because the economy powered American society, it threw off a tremendous amount of waste product. And that waste product happened to be black people who didn't want to be involved in slavery. It happened to be white people who had nothing to do and no vested interest in slavery. And it happened to be entire cities, entire states, entire societies that were victimized by the brutality that the economics of slavery represented.
And even entrapped, if you will. So it was like many of them were slaves, not just the blacks.
Well, Frederick Douglass said it best. He said that slavery made slaves of us all.
Right,
victims of us all.
Right.
It was very hard. You know, looking back, it's easy to see now how white people were victimized by slavery. At the time, I'm not sure that was the case, although there are several characters in the book who kind of have that same notion about.
You mentioned up front, though, that this is really about relationships, and I think it's probably more about relationships between black and whites and that complex relationship that slavery kind of created.
Yeah, well, slavery did present and create a complex world of relationships between blacks and whites because most white people didn't own slaves.
Right.
And so, but yet those that did not own slaves were deeply affected by slavery. Because slavery was something that was it was a powerful institution. It would be as if someone decided, you know, outside the door here that no one can drive a car for 3 weeks. Well, that would just stop everyone. It would just create enormous differences in terms of how we dealt with these problems. So slavery affected everyone.
Well, I want to kind of go through a few of the characters so that as we talk a little bit more about the story, they'll be familiar to our listeners. Liz, of course, is the prominent young woman, the slave who's escaping, and she's also called the Dreamer. How did she get that nickname?
Well, because the book begins with her being trapped in a slave stealer's attic with 14 other slaves, and she tells the other slaves her dreams of the future. And so they call her the Dreamer. And in exchange for telling her dreams of the future, an old woman to whom she's chained next to tells Liz the code. In other words, the book begins when Liz is trapped with these other slaves, and she's chained next to an old woman, and the woman says, "Tell me your dreams." And Liz says, "I'm afraid to." And the woman says, "Well, if you tell me your dreams, I'll tell you the code." And mm-hmm. So Liz says, "What's the code?" And then the woman begins to tell her a cryptic series of elements that were known as the black codes from the underground that were used on the Underground Railroad.
Now, I had heard of a few of them, the things like the quilt and the broken twigs and, of course, and the crooked...
Scratching a crooked line
right,
in the dirt.
Because... evil travels in a straight line.
Right.
But some of them you probably made up, right?
Some I made up and some I got from a book. I can't remember the name of the book, but it's called Hidden in Plain View.
And when we say code, we're talking about things...
Clues.
Yes.
Clues that blacks would use when they were on the Underground Railroad. So that if two were running, if you saw someone on the road, you didn't have to say anything. If you scratched a crooked line in the dirt, that meant you could be trusted.
Right.
If that person didn't understand what that crooked line meant, you would just keep on getting
up.
Yeah,
be careful of him. Right. You know, we don't really think a whole lot about whites being part of the Underground Railroad, but yet, without them, we probably wouldn't have...
Well, you know, it wouldn't have worked.
Right.
And the other thing is that a lot of whites who were part of the Underground Railroad were not necessarily the whites that you expected. Like Waterman, for example, you know, who were the fishermen of the Eastern Shore.
Right. I wanted to ask you about them. Talk about them for a moment.
Well, Watermen weren't fond of slaves, nor were they fond of slave owners. They were very independent, suspicious, kind of prejudiced people. Yet they were deeply religious, and as they began to get ideas about the lack of godliness that slavery represented, some of them actually began to work for the Gospel Train, which is the Underground Railroad was called the Gospel Train. And also, people underestimate the role that free blacks played in the Underground Railroad, because the Eastern Shore had a lot of free blacks.
The watermen you mentioned, many of them, and these were mainly white men, many of them came from parents who were indentured servants, so maybe that's
right. They had a real connection. I mean, Frederick Douglass writes in his books about watermen. In fact, when Frederick Douglass got old and went back to the Eastern Shore, because he was born on the Eastern Shore of Maryland where this book takes place, he said, "I am above all an Eastern Shore waterman." They had a certain culture. They had a certain style. They had a certain language. And because they were dependent on each other, too. These men went out on the water. Black and white watermen would go out in the Chesapeake Bay for miles to grab these oysters off the bottom of the bay. And it was dangerous work, so they were dependent on each other.
That
codependency led to a lot of work together when it came to the Underground Railroad.
What was it about the Maryland Shore that attracted so many of these runaway slaves?
Because African Americans knew that if you got to the Eastern Shore of Maryland, your chances of getting to Philadelphia were pretty good.
So what's the big deal about
80 miles?
What was the big deal about getting to Philadelphia?
Well, first of all, because when Harriet Tubman and Frederick Douglass and the others were going, they most of the people went through the water. They're realizing they pulled a lot of these people to freedom, not over land, but over and through water, through canal. The Eastern Shore is full of creeks and canals and swamps. It's full of them. That's all the Eastern Shore is. And so when you got to the Eastern Shore, once you hit that water, you're wading in the water. Goodbye. You make it to Philly, you know, 80 miles, you know.
You know, that's another one of those songs, Wade in
yeah,
the
that's
Water.
Yeah, you know, a lot of those songs were, right. You know, a lot of those songs were part of the Underground Railroad messages, songs that we sang in church when I was a little boy.
Well, you did a great job of blending fact and fiction in the story. For instance, you mentioned that the river that you talked about...
The Choptank River.
Choptank River mm-hmm. is real.
Yeah.
But the burial ground...
The Indian burial ground is not.
Is not. And let's talk about... Is it Paddy Cannon?
Well... Paddy Cannon was a real slave stealer, and she really stole slaves, and she put them in her attic, and then she would make deals, and she would hold them until slave traders came up from New Orleans in their boats to the Chesapeake to the Chesapeake Bay, and she would sell them to slave traders, and then these slaves would be taken back to New Orleans, and they would never be seen again.
Wow.
So she was a ruthless and very apparently very pretty woman, a big woman, and she was someone that African-Americans were very frightened of. And she was a real person. You know, you can't make that kind of stuff up.
You know? She was really a very celebrated gangster, didn't she? A big gang.
Yeah, she had a big gang. She had a gang of five or six real, you know, very smart, calculating businessmen who basically snatched slaves off the street.
Well, and they didn't limit it to slaves either, did they? Freedmen?
They would kill slave traders as well if there was enough money involved. Mm. Because the whole business of slavery and trading slaves was nasty business. Society really didn't want to have a lot to do with it. So those who dealt in the slave trade were not that respected by higher members of society, and they were not liked by a lot of white citizens as well, because they were considered to be people who dealt almost like, you know, I don't know, weapons manufacturers.
Right,
you know?
Right.
So they were not well liked.
Let's go back to some of the other characters that were very significant. Amber. Amber is a young... Very, I think he's rather ambivalent, isn't he? Or is it the word ambiguous?
He's probably ambivalent and ambiguous. I mean, he wants to run away. He knows if he runs away that his sister will probably be sold, and that his mistress will lose her farm because his mistress is widowed. Mm-hmm. And his brother-in-law and his master both drowned on the Chesapeake. And so he's been planning his run to freedom for years. You know, he avoided getting married. He's about ready to go, and now he has to make a decision about whether to leave or not, knowing that if he goes, his sister will be sold into slavery, sold south, and his nephew, whom he adores, is sold south. And also the little white kid that he grew up, that he basically raised, will be gone from his life forever as well. So
a tough choice between love and or freedom.
Well, you know, it was a hard life.
Yeah.
The emotional life of slavery is something that's very, very rarely discussed. You know, because we just get caught up in the brutality of it. But the web of relationships is just as fascinating. Kathleen Sullivan, who owns Amber, knows he wants to run away. Mm-hmm. She can see that he smells freedom over her head.
80 miles away, huh?
Just 80 miles away. You can climb a tree and almost see it. And then, you know, from the chest. And she knows it. And she knows he's smelling it. And yet she can't bring herself to sell him because she's known him since he was she loves him. I mean, not
right, in a romantic sense.
Not in a romantic sense, but she loves him as a member. She sees him as a member of her own family.
Right. Why wasn't Liz, the dreamer, why wasn't she anxious to take the gospel train?
To take the gospel train north?
Because she saw the future.
She saw the future, and she thought freedom wasn't in the North. You can ask black folks now; they'll tell you that's true. Ask any black person from Brooklyn; they'll say, "Yeah, you're right." But you know, she thought freedom wasn't in the North because she saw the future. In the future, she saw young men driving around in chariots with rubber wheels, shooting guns outside the windows, and she saw, you know, she saw children running away from books like they were poison, and she saw
that line cut me to the quick. You know, that children were running away from books like they were poison.
It's hard.
But
to, you know,
in a sense, though,
in a sense, it happens.
Kids aren't reading anymore.
Right.
Many of them.
Right.
And it's, is that, it almost sounded a little bit like some of the gangster culture or hip-hop culture, if you
will.
Well,
you know, I mean, I'm not against hip-hop culture. Mm-hmm. I'm not against hip-hop. I think it's a great art form. But some of it has just crossed the line. Mm-hmm. It needs to be said. Some of it is just slavery.
And that's
up
what
and down.
She was seeing.
That's what she was seeing. She didn't understand it.
Right.
If you have to explain the art to someone, how much of is it art? I mean, you know, like I can understand when Coltrane toward the end of his life, you know, you heard his music, it just sounded like, you know, like someone going nuts. But at least there was a, you know, 15-year period before that where you could just like you could snap your fingers to it. But if you have to explain like someone like, you know, committing a sex act against a woman or shooting someone because you disrespect them over a pair of tennis shoes,
yeah.
You have to explain that. How much is that art and how much is that pathology? So, I mean, that what she sees, at least in part, is the pathology. And there's no one to explain it to her. So she decides she doesn't want to run to the North. Because there's no freedom. She's seen tomorrow. There.
Right.
So,
and unlike Nostradamus, hers was just a little bit too relevant to today.
Well, I mean, eventually she has to make a break because she's a wanted person. She's being chased.
Does she have any hope?
Yes, she does. Yes, she does. But the hope in this book comes from, you know, it comes from the woolman.
The woolman. Let's talk about him.
It comes from the woolman. The woolman is a free black who's never been enslaved. He lives in the woods by himself, away from all of it. And Liz,
almost like a Bigfoot kind of character.
Yeah, I mean, you could say that he's a big, strong, gorgeously black person.
Right.
You know, with just, you know, his cut, he's sculpted. He moves through the swamps very cleverly, and you know, he knows how to. He can almost
camouflage,
make himself invisible.
Right.
Yeah, he's a wonderful character.
Yes.
And yet he's an innocent. He's not an angry person. He doesn't hate white people. He doesn't hate black people. He's been taught by his mother to avoid all people. Mm. And then Liz, by accident, stumbles upon his son, who's caught in a trap, and she frees him. And so she gains an unwary and somewhat wild and unpredictable ally in the woolman. But the woolman really is the key to the song yet sung, and he's the key to the future, because it's his ancestry, really, that powers the book. It's his desire for innocence and freedom that really makes that Liz eventually discovered.
Well, if you've just tuned in, I'm Valerie Jackson, and I'm going Between the Lines with best-selling author James McBride. His book, The Color of Water, appears on high school and university lists across the country. And as I mentioned earlier, it's the story of a young African-American boy that grew up with a very strict Jewish mother. But today we're talking about his latest book, Sung Yet Sung, about the escaping slaves. Is that the only alternative, though, that he has to go into the woods and live almost like a hermit?
At that time.
Well, I guess.
Well, see, the woman had no choice, because when he was six, his mother ran away, and she just ran away into the woods, and then she taught him, you know, this is how you live in the woods, and then she died. She died when he was 11. So he just had to continue living the way she had taught him to live. And he had no choice. What were the choices then?
Right.
You know,
especially if you're searching for an identity, and I think I read somewhere where you said that, quote, identity is everything.
Identity powers the whole thing.
Everything in the world. Why do you say that? What do you mean?
Well, I mean, even today, you know, I mean, what am I? Am I an American? Am I black? Or, you know, you can label someone anything. You can, you know, I'm biracial. What is that? I mean, you know, these labels may mean nothing. God doesn't check your passport. He doesn't care if you're from Iraq or from America. He's not going to check. Nowhere in the Bible does it say America. Not one word. So, you know, who are you, you know? I mean, the best I can come up with is I'm trying my best to be a child of God.
Right. What about that word freedom? I think it probably meant a lot of different things to the different characters in the book. 'Cause, for instance, we didn't mention him, but we need to, and that's the Gimp. What was his real name?
Denwood Long.
Denwood,
yeah.
Right.
Well,
right.
The Gimp is a waterman who was also the greatest slave catcher in Dorchester County. And he's retired because he's drunk and his wife left him and his child died. But he takes on this one last job because Liz's master offered him a lot of money. So he takes on the job for the money. But yet he's ambiguous about slavery, partly because his father, even though his father died poor, his father was against slavery. And he has a lot of ambiguous feelings about this whole business of freedom. It makes him angry that blacks have a God.
Right.
And it makes him angry that blacks want to be free, because he says, what's freedom? Is freedom, you know, like becoming like the plantation owners where you can own other people? Is that freedom? How do you define freedom?
Freedom to be poor.
Freedom to be poor. Freedom to be poor like a poor white person like me.
Right.
And even if you become rich, you become like a plantation owner, then you own other souls. Is that freedom? So this guy is really deep, and he's profound. He's someone that blacks know very well. They don't necessarily.
Why do you say that? Why do you say that?
Because they know him, like the way you know, cops in Brooklyn are known to my, you know, some of the young kids around. They know that they know him that way. So there's a kind of a wary distrust, but there is a
at the same
sort of
time,
a knowledge,
right,
and a kind of a trust that exists, because they know. If there's no bounty on your head, he doesn't care if you run free. He got 70. Harriet Tubman could run past him with 70 slaves. He wouldn't be bothered with him because he's not paid to catch any of them.
Interesting point.
He only wants to catch the one he's paid to catch. Okay. So there's kind of a wary trust between him and the blacks in the area.
You mentioned Harriet Tubman just now, and that's basically kind of who Liz was supposed to
She was inspired by her.
Right, was inspired. The similarities in the, especially the head injury that caused
the dreaming.
Yes, the dreaming.
Well, you know, Harriet Tubman was, you know, when you look at her pictures and you read her stories, it's kind of like an Aesop's fable almost.
Yeah,
like,
she was a mystic, I think.
Oh, she was heavy. She was deep.
Yeah.
You know, she was powerful. I mean, she was powerfully brilliant, you know, and she must have been physically very strong as well.
Well, if she didn't have to be, if she had that pistol.
Well, that's true. But, you know, if you read through her diaries, you know, when they have her talking, she said at one point, she mentions the Waterman. You know,
right?
She mentions the Waterman. She said, I paid a Waterman to do this, and I moved in this Waterman. Harriet Tubman was deep, really profoundly deep.
Yeah.
And she's not been really explored in terms of fiction, and this was one reason that I wanted to kind of, you know, use some of her magic.
Something you said once struck me too. Songs are markers in our lives. You know, we remember things by songs, and you're so true about that.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. You know, when Grover Washington passed away, I worked with Grover for a while, and. You know, I hear his music. I can remember exactly what I was doing when I first heard Mr. Magic, you know.
Yes.
I know exactly what I was doing. I know where I was. And all of us have that.
Yeah. The whole black music culture, you said, is bent toward freedom. The gospels with their steal away, and even jazz, which is freedom from the traditional kind of.
Oh, yeah. I mean, even hip-hop, even healthy hip-hop is geared toward freedom. I mean, when you talk about, you know, Public Enemy and some of the great hip-hop and some of the stuff that Nas and Common do, you know, these artists. I mean, much of it is geared toward freedom because that's the wall we push against. It's the mental wall we push towards now.
Will the song yet sung from your novel be sung, be recognized in our time, do you think?
I don't know. I hope so, you know. A lot of people have sung the song already, and they've kicked the door down, and some of us are walking through, and some of us don't see the door yet. It's our responsibility, those of us who are writers and artists and thinkers, to show everybody else that the door is open. Come this way. So, you know, we have to sing that song louder. Now, it hasn't been sung yet all the way, but the melody's in the air.
Something you mentioned I just thought of, too, is that when you talk about the many of the walls that existed during slavery, the classism, the racism, the economic issues, they're still walls that are facing society today. So what would you like for the reader to take away, or would you like to leave with the reader with respect to what this book might say to them?
Well, I'd like people to come away with the business to understand that our commonalities far outweigh our differences. We had a lot in common during slavery. We had a lot to think about. We were all enslaved to this thought of human bondage. And now that we're free of it physically, it's about freeing ourselves from it mentally, because it hinders us as a society when we think of each other as unequals. It's not really democratic. It's not the American way. And it's not just black folks' problem. It's all of our problem. That's really the true issue. And as soon as you can get white America to see that, or get white folks to see that, and they're starting to see it now, particularly because of the situation America's in.
Well, you were well prepared to write this book because your research, I mean, you even went to Italy, not on this book, but in the past, you know, for instance, Miracle at St. Anna, you lived in Italy. In this book, you lived up in, you went to Chesapeake.
Yeah, Eastern Shore, Maryland.
Right. But research, and you say research is very, very important. It's everything. But, you know, you said something that really struck me. You said that you have to research, but then you have to hold back what you've learned and just use the small bit of it.
Well, you know, you can't just sip the suds off the top of the beer. That's it. Otherwise, you know, you're just going to end up getting drunk and crashing to somebody on the way home. You just want to get the thought in people's heads. You don't want to knock people over the head with a story that they don't want to read. You have to create characters who are ambiguous and believable. And so you can't tell everybody everything. And you just have to know enough to tell a good story. You know?
Absolutely.
I mean, nobody cares about how the cow is slaughtered. They just want to eat the hamburger. You know?
Before we end, I just want to ask you about one thing. You are very involved in music and writing. But you say that they're quite different in terms of your approach to creation or creating them. How is that so?
Well, I mean, I can't listen to music when I'm writing, and I can't think about writing when I'm doing music. Most of the musicians I say to me, they who know I write, they say, man, why do you play music? And most of the writers I know who know I'm a musician say, man, why are you writing? You know, they both think the grass is greener on the other side. They're just two different disciplines. I happen to like them both, and I have to think of them separately. I can't use music to inspire me. Because I think about it, I say, what key is it in? Is it in D flat? I hate that key. It's in B? I don't even want to touch B. You know what I mean? So, and I get into analyzing, this is the chorus, this is the verse, you know. Bass player, he's out of tune at bar five. You know, I can't hear it free, you know. So it's same thing with writing. I can't read a book and not analyze what this guy has done.
Well, thank you so much, James, for being with us today and allowing us to go between the lines with you.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, as we go out, why don't we just listen to just a little bit of your jazz CD called The Process. And until next week, I'm Valerie Jackson, reminding you that there's always more to learn when you go between the lines. To learn more about the books and authors featured on Between the Lines, listen to an archived program or browse our suggested reading list for both adults and children. Visit our website at wabe.org/BTL. To subscribe to a podcast of the program, go to npr.org. Join us next week for another engaging program, because there's always more to learn when you go Between the Lines. The executive producer of this program is Lois Reitzes. Producer, Marjorie Lancer. Editor, Mike Johns. Technical producer, Ken Merry. Production assistant, Soo Young Jung. Opening and closing music by Afro Blue. And I'm your host, Valerie Jackson. For information on how to be a funder for Between the Lines, please call 678-686-0390. Between the Lines is a production of 90.1 WABE.